Good morning. Morning. So this morning, I want to talk about cons. Ted Toole, there's Ted, last week talked about a con, and we're going to be talking about cons in our practice period for something like 8 weeks. So I thought, why not get the ball rolling? And furthermore, I just gave a bunch of talks on cons at the retreat in Hokioji, so I get to use that material. Some people have the privilege of hearing it twice, which is a great privilege in Zen. But anyway. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about three kinds of cons. And then next week I'm going to talk about two more kinds. Cons are very simply encounters which have been written down between Zen students or between a student and a teacher or between two teachers starting in the 7th century in China. So they're stories that were written down, recorded, and talked about, used as teaching tools over the centuries. And use its teaching tools in a variety, in a wide variety of ways. So that's really all there is to it. Now they to some people they are very puzzling stories, but nevertheless they are stories, and there's a Zen truth embedded in each of them, or a Zen pointer, if not a truth, a pointer. So today, I will talk about first koans that are represent the relative absorbed into the absolute. Then I will talk about koans that represent the absolute manifesting as the relative. Then I will talk about emptiness koans. And I'll, of course, this is going to not be a 10-hour talk, so I'm just going to go give you three short examples for each. And the next time I'm going to talk about encouragement cons and appreciation of life cons. Okay? So, first of all, the relative absorbed into the absolute. We could say, in our vernacular, small mind, little-mindedness, absorbed into big mind. Our worries, our fears, our pettiness, absorbed into something huge. Some mind that includes everything, that is really not a mind, but we won't get into that. It's the absolute. It's timeless. And so the absorption of the little mind, of the poor little Tim, of the poor little whomever, into the big mind, are what this first set is about, okay? Which actually happens in Zen practice. Believe it or not, it happens. So the first one. The student asks the teacher, what was Ni Tao? After he met the fourth ancestor, his teacher. What was Ni Tao after he met the fourth ancestor? The teacher asks, the moth in the flame swallows the tiger. So the moth in the flame. The moth, each of us is a moth with our little minds, with our little worries, which really seem big, don't they? Our big worries. As in our Zen practice, we get close to the flame. We get close to something really large that will not only still our small mind, but actually completely absorb it, completely, in a sense, devour it, but in a wonderful way, not in an awful way. I know it sounds, it feels scary sometimes, but in a wonderful way. The moth who fully goes into the difficulty of what it is to really live, to really do Zen practice in the world, not in a monastery, but right here, in the office, at home, on the cushion, who goes into that difficulty and feels the heat. Feels the heat. If you don't feel the heat, you're not doing Zen practice. You may be doing a lot of other kinds of practice, like alcohol or drugs or some other kind of addictive practice. But if you're not addicting to anything, you're going to feel the heat. It's just life. You'll feel the heat. If you're sincere, if you're sincere, if you're really trying to live in a straightforward, kind, and honest way, you'll feel the heat. So this is about doing the Zen practice right here, wherever we are, and letting our self-image melt, because it doesn't work. It only holds up for so long. At some point, we just have to let our self-image melt and be here and be part of this and commit ourselves to this. We have to swallow our fear of being scared of big mind, being scared of dissolving through practice. Fear of getting nowhere in practice. Getting nowhere in Zen practice. Practicing for 31 years and having the same shit come up. And just as much, with just as much intensity as it did 31 years ago. And what a waste that would be. Fear of that, right? Fear of that. Fear of not being recognized. Practicing and practicing and practicing, and nobody recognizes that you're a little bit calmer. That you're a little bit more generous. Your spouse still treats you like you're out to lunch, right? Your kids still treat you like you're whatever. And here you've been practicing. Fear of not being recognized. When we do something, we want people to recognize that there's some change. Especially this kind of work. Maybe not transformation, maybe that's too big a word. Some change. Some change, something. So that's the moth going to the flame. And the moth goes into the flame, it swallows the tiger. The tiger is our courage. It takes courage to do this. It takes courage to keep with this meditation practice day after day. Retreat after retreat. Success after success. Failure after failure. It takes courage. Takes courage when that stuff comes up again and again and again, just to see it, just to acknowledge it, just to let it be there, without fighting it, without pushing it away, without telling a new story about it. That takes courage. This is a courageous practice. That's why we always have the tiger up there. Only that tiger looks like he's taking a nap. That's okay. The tiger can learn how to take a nap, but it takes 32 years or 47 years. And then you can take a nap. That's fine. Wherever you are, you'll be able to take a nap. Really. My teachers, my two Japanese teachers, they came down to my hometown of Palo Alto to give talks when I was very young. First Suzuki Roshi and then Katagiri Roshi. And then they were driven home during rush hour from Palo Alto to San Francisco. Oh, it was awful, rush hour. Really bad in California in those days. Not that it has gotten much better. Well, they added a few more lanes to the freeways, you know. And what did they do? Well, my friend Philip took Suzuki Roshi back and forth to my little group. And then he said, I said, well, how is it driving with Suzuki Roshi? He said, oh, it's fine, it's fine. He said, but you know, last week when we were driving home, he said, the traffic was awful. Everybody was beeping. I thought I was going to get rear-ended. I hate driving it. And he said, so I thought I would relax myself a little bit by telling Suzuki a dream that I had. And it was a dream, which was important to me. And he said, I told him the dream. And you know what? I said, "What? What?" He fell asleep. He fell asleep. And he slept all the way to San Francisco. Well, I was fighting traffic and the horns were beeping and the pollution was awful. The absolute dissolved. The relative dissolved into the absolute. That's the next one. I get them mixed up. Robert Aiken Roshi adds, the moth in the flame devours the tiger and begins to roar. take it in, he says. So I have two other examples of, well, it's only quarter after, I guess. I have two other examples of this first kind. The first, the second example, which I talked about in the retreat, is about Suzuki Roshi. So Suzuki Roshi was a Soto teacher. He was a Soto student. He grew up in a Soto temple, Soto Zen, right? And but then, when he was a young man, his teacher said, "Well, you know, you should get a taste of Rinzai Zen. Rinzai Zen was all around. You should get a taste of it. So go do a Rinzai retreat for a week." It's good. It's good if you're a Zen student to get a taste of some other teachers. You know, this is really a good idea. You should all do that. Some other ways of practicing and teaching. And so he got there, and it was very awkward for him. He didn't know anything about it. It really disturbed his mental set. It disturbed his self-image, because he was a Soto priest. And these people were doing these koans. And these, in the way the Rinzai, I mean, we just talk about them and then we relax in our sitting and then we talk about them again and then relax in our sitting and then forget about them and then change them around. But this Rinzai retreat was very serious. Everybody had a koan. Everybody was expected to do a koan. And they said, "This is Shunryu, you need a koan too." Okay, my teacher wanted me, I'll take a koan. So I gave him, of course, the Mu Koan, M-U. Does the dog have Buddha nature? M-U, W-U in Chinese, means no or no thing, or nothing. Three different translations, right? So when you're supposed to, you know, focus on it. So Suzuki Roshi was there for the whole week, and he felt really out of place. But he was focusing. He was in every way he could, even though he didn't do the ritual, he didn't know what was going on. But see, that was all good for him, because that put the moth closer to the flame, because he was out of his normal way of being. Our normal way of being is okay, but Zen is to go beyond the normal way of being, so we can be in the absolute, in big mind. We're in big mind anyway, but it takes some shaking up to kind of realize it, to kind of feel it, to kind of express it. And so he knew in that Rinzai session that he went to, people would run to Doksan. They ran to Doksan. There'd be lines up, and they'd run. Not exactly like our retreats, right? And they run and they line up, and the teacher would go ding, and then another person would come in, they would do something, and you didn't know what was going on because it was private. Then the ding would be about 10 seconds later, and the person would be out of there. And so Suzuki Roshi didn't even want to go in. But you had to go in three times a day in this retreat, in this Rinzai retreat, at least three times. They preferred eight times a day or 10 times a day. And Suzuki Roshi's teacher had already told him he was enlightened, because he'd had all these experiences, and then he made him go do this thing. And so he went in his three times a day. He didn't know what he was doing. The teacher said, "Show Mu, express Mu." And he said, you know, he said a few things. I don't know what he did. He was confused. He always got rung right out. Dong, dong. And then something like the sixth day at the Sesshin, He went up there, and he had been very focused all morning, right in the middle of his confusion, really focused. And just moo, 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 saying it. It was his, it had become every, all of his concentration was moo, 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 everything, everything. And, so when he walked in, he opened the door, and I talked about this at retreat. Oh, I forgot this key part. The teacher's name is his nickname is Tanker, because he's built like a sumo wrestler. Rinzai. Tanker, right? And Suzuki Roshi is about 4'11" and weighs about 98 pounds on a good day, right? So Suzuki Roshi, he is nothing but moo when he walks in. Do you know what I mean? When you're completely still and you're completely focused, he is nothing but moo. And it doesn't have to be moo, it could be anything. He's nothing but just this. And he walks in and he looks at Tanker and he sees, I am Tanker. That's what he sees. I am Tanker. Tanker is me. And then Tanker pats him on the head, says, good boy. But he still rings him right out. So, the relative absorbed within the absolute. That's our practice. That happens in our practice. If it doesn't happen to you, that's okay. But if you keep practicing, you really practice every day, and you do retreats, it'll happen. The third one. The third example that I talked about at retreat is the wild ducks. The wild duck, blue case record number 53. Matsa and Baijiang, the Zen teacher Matsa. Zen teacher Matsa and his student Baijiang are out for a walk. And Matsa and something flies over them. We won't say what. And Matsa says to Baijiang, what is that? His student, he says to his student, what is that? His student says, oh, those are wild ducks. This student, and then they walk a couple more steps, two or three more steps. Matsu looks up at the sky again. He says, where do they go? The student says, they flew away. And what does Matsu do then? He grabs the student's nose and twists it, and he says, how can they have flown away? Or maybe he says, how can they have flown away? That's a little better, isn't it? How can they have flown away? So this student, he has been practicing. He has been practicing hard Zen, good Zen. He knows you're in the now in Zen. You're not in the past. You're not in the future. That's shitty Zen. Real Zen is mu, right? In the now. And here his teacher is getting a little senile already. He's saying, oh, where do the ducks go? Come on, teacher. Come on, get with it. You're supposed to be my teacher. They've flown away, honey. They've flown away. But Matsa twists his nose. Where could they go? Because we divide the past, present, and future up in our small mind. We divide it up. And then we live based on the past, projecting into the future, and they think the three of them are different. They're not different. They're not different. It's just our thinking that makes them different. So when my father died in March of 2008, I guess it was, I went out to in my home, and I took his ashes to San Francisco, where he was born and grew up, where I spent a lot of time when I was a young boy. And I took them to, I only took half of his ashes because my sister got the other half. That was a good arrangement. And I took them up, and I wanted to spread them down. My father grew up by the ocean in San Francisco in a house that went way down to the ocean. I wanted to spread them way down below his house. And I had spent a lot of time at the house, especially when I was a young boy. As a young boy, my parents, when they wanted to do stuff, would always leave me with my grandmother. So we went up, and I knew how to find the house. And I had not been to the house in at least 50 years. And I had not really spent quality time in the house for 60 years. You must think that was before I was born, but I'm afraid not. I'm 66, so I had not spent time there for 60 years. And I had the ashes, and I had my wife and my son with me, who were a little more reticent to go up and ask people, but not me. So I saw these people in the driveway, and I said, "Oh, hi, you know, this is my grandmother's house." And they were very fascinated. They knew about the family. They never met my grandmother. I said, "This is my father's house." She said, "Oh, she knew about the family." So they invited us in. They were very friendly. And in San Francisco, it's hard to make renovation on houses. You've got to get 32 permits. So houses out in the Seacliff area are very seldom they do anything to them. So the house was exactly the same. Exactly the same. And the minute I walked in the door, I opened the door and walked into the house with these people, and then I saw the kitchen door ajar, and I saw into the kitchen. The minute I did that, I smelled my grandmother's bread baking in the oven. I smelled it. I smelled the bread in the oven. And then I tasted her tapioca. She made homemade tapioca for me, just for me, every day. I tasted the tapioca, and then I smelled my grandmother. I smelled her talcum-like odor that I remember so well from when I was 5 and younger. So tell me that the past, present, and future are different. Tell me, Baijing, that they're different. Tell me that anything is different from anything else. We get these ideas about what Zen is. And Zen is just not that idea. It's just not that idea. That's all I can say. First kind of calm. See, do I have time? Oops. Well, we'll see. Second kind of calm. The absolute manifested within the relative. The absolute manifested within the relative. The student comes to the teacher. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to the West? The teacher says, the oak tree in the garden. The oak tree in the garden. In the longer version, the student then says, please don't teach me referring to outside things. These are impudent students, aren't they? Are you guys that impudent? I haven't noticed this. Please don't teach me referring to outside things. I don't teach you referring to outward things. Well, then what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to the West, the oak tree in the garden? Redundancy. Really, only one teaching. Yeah, we say the 5 koans, the 32 koans. Just one teaching, you guys. Just one teaching. But in this form, it's the absolute win in the relative, the absolute manifesting itself as the relative. And Lin Chi and Rinzai, the same guy, right? Lin Chi in China, Rinzai in Japan. If Bodhidharma had any meaning, he could not have saved even himself. Because he had a message, but he just came. He completely came. He was. If we completely are what we are in the world, as the world, of the world, then meaning or not meaning? Yeah, sure. Meaning, not meaning. Those are just, and most people really want meaning. I know that. I know that. It's important to have meaning, but it's also important to see that it's somewhat arbitrary, your ideas, our ideas about meaning and not meaning. So the Zen teacher was asked, and this is, I don't know if this is a Japanese story or a Chinese story, but it's a story in which cats are like squirrels in Minneapolis. They have the status of squirrels, okay? So this story, because they do actually in China and Japan, pretty much have the status of squirrels. And they're all over the place. They're getting into everything. They're pesty. So the teacher asks the student, what's the most meaningful thing in the world? And the student asks the teacher. And the teacher says, a dead cat. And he says, a dead cat, because nobody can put any value on it. Because nobody can put any value on it. So we put value on, I put value on Monica, but not on Matt. And then as soon as I do that, there's a split. There's a split. There's a split between the three of us. Because I want something from Monica, and I don't want anything from Matt. On and on and on we do that, right? So in our big mind, we see this. And the very seeing is the beginning of freeing. It's not total freeing, but it's the beginning of freeing. Total freeing then is to act on the vision, to act on the seeing. So what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to the rest? What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming, making that long trip from India to China? The bike rack in the backyard? The squirrels in the tree? You guys sitting looking so like you're paying attention to me? What is the meaning? Meaning is okay, but this is more full than meaning, this life. It's more full because it just is involved in what is without dividing up. So I went to Suzuki Roshi once and had a Doksan with him. And this was after I had some nice woo-woo enlightenment experience. And he said to me, this is the second koan in this of the absolute manifested within the relative. See, I'm doing some Suzuki Roshi koans too, because once they get written down, of course, this hasn't been written down yet, but so it's not really a koan. Once it got written down and somebody else talked about it, it would be a koan. So people have actually put a book out of Suzuki Roshi koans. I saw that. But I have my own internal book of his koans that someday, I've been talking about this for 15 years, I'll write down. So anyway, so I went into him and he said, now you have attained so-called enlightenment. I thought, oh, he saw it. He acknowledged it. Wow, it's about time. And then he said, what did he say next? Do you remember?
But that sounds Zen.
That's a different one. that's koan number one, actually. This is koan number 32 or something. I'm just making this up, you know. This is much after that. Much after that. Because in that one... Okay, but anyway, that's different. He said, now you've attained so-called enlightenment. I passed by the so-called. I just heard the enlightenment. Now it is time, he said, and he pointed to the door, to take care of those. My sandals were by the door, and his sandals were by the door, and his sandals were clean and neat, and they were lined up, and they looked beautiful. They just fit the symmetry of the room and the symmetry of the universe. My sandals, on the other hand, I am not going to talk to you guys about, because I don't want to offend you or you to get a bad impression of me.
Leaving it to our imagination.
The absolute within the relative, the absolute as the relative, right? And the third example I talked about at retreat. Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara koans almost always are the absolute manifested within the relative. And that's because Avalokiteshvara has hundreds of arms, hundreds of eyes, hundreds of hands. And you know why Avalokiteshvara has them? As the Bodhisattva of compassion, he, she has them to help all beings. Because beings need help in lots of different ways. So here is the personification in Avalokiteshvara of the absolute manifested in the relative. In the relative. So a story that I have not told for maybe 4 years about that, but some of you will remember probably, is about being in Zimbabwe when I visited my daughter in the Peace Corps many years ago. My wife and I visited her in the Peace Corps, and in those days you could go to Zimbabwe and it was wonderful. And we were in Zimbabwe and we were on the Zambezi River in Zimbabwe, right below Victoria Falls, where the rapids are very huge. And we just, my daughter and I, but not my wife, because she was sane, the sane one, I guess, decided we wanted to go on a rubber raft and run the rapids with these guides. And we thought it would be fun to run the rapids with these guides. So we, you know, the first thing that I noticed was they made us sign things. So I should have known then that they made us sign things saying that they weren't liable. I should have got the clue, right? So we signed these forms about them not being liable for us, for our well-being. And then we got in our rubber rafts, and there were about 8 people to a rubber raft, and there were maybe about 4 or 5 rafts, and each raft had a leader, had a Zen master in front who was leading us down the rapids, right? African Zen master. Only I don't know about these guys. So I saw in the rapids in front of us, I saw one of the rafts capsize. And I thought, my God. And then 10 seconds later, we were over. We were completely over. Now, we must have had life jackets on. You know, I haven't talked to my daughter about this in a while. We must have had life jackets on. I know I remember holding on to something underwater. But we were under what seemed like a long time. It seemed like a long time, and we were going through rapids. And I was holding on to something, and I was underwater. You know, I could see the top of the raft, right, because it was turned over. Then, after I don't know how long, it seemed like about 5 minutes, but it couldn't have been because, you know, I would have been... Aren't you dead in 5 minutes? So it righted up. We were through the rapids, and then we just cruised down. And of course, they cruised us right over the shore. And my daughter, Erin was pretty good. She was probably better than me. But the people in front of us were weeping. They were weeping, and they said they were both going to die. Everybody was just a mess, and they pulled the raft over to the shore. And the African guy seemed a little bit indifferent, frankly. I mean, not to put him down, but a little bit indifferent. I mean, I don't know. He probably thought, oh, we were fine, you know, what's the big deal? I mean, I don't know what he thought. But there was this one man there whom I call the man in the parrot shirt, because he was a big man, and he was wearing a parrot shirt. I didn't even want to sit by him. I don't like to sit by those guys, you know, those who seem so American. It's like when I'm in other countries, I just want to... Anyway, man in the parrot shirt, big parrots all over his shirt. He began going around and saying to people, oh, do you need a glass of a drink of water? And the woman who was crying, he helped her find her glasses. The man who was shivering, he got a little blanket and put it around him. He just went around and he helped those people. It was just some guy on the boat. He was really for me and Erin, and he got... I needed water. It's funny that I needed water, but I needed water. And he asked me if I said, yes, water. And he got me water. He got Erin water. And we all calmed down because of the man in parrot shirt. because of Avalokiteshvara, because of the absolute in the relative, which is always here. It's always here. But in a situation of extremity, it comes out more. We've all read stories about it coming out more. In situations of extremity, people give up their small minds. Well, they don't always, but they can give up their small minds. They can see the big mind just in whatever, not as something separate from them. They feel it, and they help. They help. And you know what Katagiri Roshi used to talk about? He used to say, life is an emergency case. We are always in a situation of extremity. We don't think we are, but we're in a situation of extremity right now. Right now. At this very minute. We always are. We could get cancer tomorrow. We could die in the next minute. My grandchildren could be killed while I'm talking to you. We're in an emergency case. A situation of extremity. It's the human situation, isn't it? Really? But we lull ourselves into some sort of mesmerized, nice internal dialogue storytelling trance, or shitty internal dialogue telling storytelling trance, right? There's negative hypnosis and positive hypnosis going on all the time, right? So that's the second type of corn. The absolute manifested within the relative. The third kind of corn. Emptiness. Emptiness. Well, of course, emptiness. First of all, to go over this, emptiness in Buddhism, really, if you look at it technically, if you're going to be a stickler for emptiness, which seems odd because... but anyway, it seems odd. But anyway, I'm going to be a stickler for emptiness for a while. Emptiness is not, if you say, the void or peacefulness or spaciousness. That's not emptiness. That's not emptiness in Buddhism, because emptiness only modifies nouns, selves, others, ups, downs. It modifies by negating their ultimate reality. So if you say, oh, I had a great experience of the void, I would say, oh, that's empty. Meaning, what do you mean? You're hanging onto that void. You're sticking to it. Really, the best synonym for emptiness is not void, but not sticking. Not sticking. That's a better synonym than void or tranquility or silence. Of course, if your mind is tranquil, if your thoughts have really slowed down, there's much more chance that you'd be less sticky. And so it's empty. So there's a correlation between empty and void, but they're not the same. Does that make sense to you guys? We say we want emptiness, but that's ridiculous. our wanting is what's empty. That's what we're sticking to. So we just have to unglue that a little bit, melt it a little bit in our zazen, in our kindness to ourselves and others. Just melt it. So I'll give three examples of emptiness. A gateless gate, number 8, which we are going to be doing in practice period. So some of you guys get a head start. Or maybe I get a head start, whatever. Yue Wan said to a monk, Xi Cheng made 100 carts. If you take off both wheels and the axle, what would be vividly apparent? So, Chang, is considered the origin in Japanese mythology of the cart, the origin of the wheel. So he's like the first person, like the original person. So that this koan, the way Robert Aiken interprets it, is it's about what happens when Tim takes off his belief that he's a Zen teacher, his belief that he's absent-minded, his belief that he's smart, his belief that he has 2 grandchildren, his belief that he has a loving wife waiting for him back home, his belief that he's 66 years old but pretty healthy except for his back, his belief that that he needs to do a better job of working out, his belief that his grandmother must be close by because he smells her tapioca, right? What happens when we take off, we discard everything? What happens? Who are we? Who are we? This is really going into emptiness. This is what emptiness means, to go into it, to look at it, to see the possibility of who that is when you divest yourself of everything you feel. Everything you feel, not just what you know, but what you feel too. It's easy to divest yourself of what you know, but what about your feelings? What about divesting yourself of those? Is it possible to see the stickiness in them and to unstick them just by seeing it? Just by letting them melt? Oh, this is emptiness, an emptiness calm. And it is for us to do ourselves. For us to go into ourselves. And I'm more than happy to go into it with you. There's nothing I would like better than to go into it with you. Nothing. 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 So emptiness is a naked encounter. It's naked. It's naked. Wu Man says about this koan, if you realize this directly, your eye is like a shooting star, and your act is like snatching a bolt of lightning. Ooh. And then the verse says, so there's usually the main case, then there's a comment, and then there's a verse. The verse says, when the wheel revolves, even a master cannot follow it. Even a master cannot follow it. The four cardinal half points, above, below, north, south, east, and west. So that's the first koan for emptiness. Two more, and then we can have some discussion, okay? Two more. Next one is gute, which very common one, which we'll be studying in practice period two. Or chuchi. We should really use the Chinese, not the Japanese, but I always make big pronunciation mistakes in the Chinese. We should have a little thing with us always. Chuchi. So it's Chuchi and his student. This is one finger. Gute is one finger. I'm going to use Gute because I'm just so used to Gute, but it is really Chuchi. So Gute, this is one of those koans that actually has an emptiness. Is an emptiness koan, but it's also a relative within the absolute koan. Because actually, when you look at these koans, you can't really categorize them like this. But I just did it because I wanted to entertain you guys. Actually, you can. Just like any categories, the categories are interesting, but they're empty. But they're interesting. Empty stuff is interesting. Interesting. It's especially interesting because we know we don't have to get all hung up about it because it's gone. It's gone, gone, gone. So empty stuff is more interesting. Don't you think? And that's everything. That's everything. Just as Red Pine reminded us, emptiness is everythingness. Emptiness is everythingness. Okay, so gute, simple story, right? Some of you could recite it, you've memorized it, because it doesn't take many brain cells to memorize it. Maybe even... Oh, I won't get into that. I've memorized it. Whenever gute is asked about Zen, what does he do? He holds up one finger. Now, we don't know if he holds up this finger or this finger or this finger or the ring finger, right? We don't know, but we're not into that, right? He holds up one finger. And that's the relative within the absolute. He's just, people are wanting to know about Zen. He's saying, look, just see this. You think Zen is somewhere else? Just really see this, really be this. Is there anything else? He does it time and time again, right? In different ways, probably using different fingers, including the middle finger, I would assume. Why not? Why not? And his student is falling around, trying to be a good student, you know, good priest, you know, getting all the moves down, right? The robes and the hair and everything. I mean, the lack of hair and everything. Although, with my students, a little bit confusing, I think. But anyway. And so one time the teacher's gone, and it's the student's turn to welcome the guests. So what does the student do? What would you do? They ask him about Zen, and he goes like this, right? He goes like this. And then what happens? Gute sees him out of the corner of his eye, and what does Gute do? He slices off his finger. Well, that's an emptiness koan. It's kind of a bloody one. I'm sorry. Seems like kind of a sadistic one, maybe, if you're thinking that way. I'm sorry. But it's an emptiness koan. The student is caught by some idea of what Zen practice is, of what Zen life is. The robe should be like this. I should be this way with the teacher. I should do this. I should do Zazen for 33 minutes a day, and maybe I won't tell the teacher if I've only done them for 32 or something like that. Da-da-da. I should be like this. So the teacher just cuts it off. Emptiness. Emptiness. And then the last part, the student runs away. Ah! Even though he's a man, a macho man, he's crying because he lost his finger, right? And he turns around, and what does the teacher do? The teacher goes like this. And he goes like this. And the student has an enlightenment experience. He has an enlightenment experience when he sees that. So that's a different kind of koan. That's a koan. That we could say that's really another koan of the absolute manifested as the relative. So the teacher then in this series starts with the absolute manifested as the relative, moves to emptiness, and then comes back to the absolute manifested as the relative. Get it? Get it? That will be a test. Well, not for you guys, just for the priests, that's all. I'm just teasing. I should be careful. So, Wu Man's comment is about this. The enlightenment of Gute and the boy has nothing to do with the end of a finger. If you can realize this, then Chuchi's teacher, or Gute's teacher, Gute, the boy, and yourself are run through with a skewer. That's an emptiness answer, right? That's an emptiness answer. So then the third one, the last one, last example of emptiness for today. Blue Cliff Record, case number 15, Umon. Student asks Umon, what is it when no thought is stirring and no thing presents itself? When no thought is stirring, we have to calm our thoughts down if we're going to get a taste of Zen. It doesn't matter if you practice for one day or three lifetimes. If you don't calm yourselves down, if you don't quit stirring your thoughts up, you can't get a real taste of it. You can't really digest it. You have to stop stirring your thoughts. You just have to. I don't care if you practice 32 minutes a day or 1 minute a day or all day. It's a requirement, because only when the thoughts are stilled and no thing presents itself can you get a taste of what I'm talking about, a really deep taste. So, the student asks, what is it, teacher, when no thought is stirring and no thing presents itself? And Umon says, Yunmen says, no preaching on oneness. That's an emptiness koan, right? No preaching on oneness. We're always preaching about something, aren't we? We're preaching to ourselves about becoming better Zen students, or getting more exercise, or moving more toward an enlightened state, or not being so sleepy when we've had our morning coffee already, or something. We're always preaching to ourselves. And this emptiness is not about preaching. We preach because we don't feel okay. Because we think people should be more like something or other. Like us or someone else. Because we don't feel okay. That's why we preach. When someone really feels okay, when they're really relaxed in the world, do they preach? Do they give advice? Do they tell people they should be different than they are? No. Do they even suggest that? No. No. They don't. They don't. So, when I was with Suzuki Roshi, he gave a talk on the precepts, and he talked about the precept of well, this is actually the precept, one of the first 10 precepts about intoxication, but he had an odd translation. Maybe he translated it himself. And he translated it as, do not sell liquor, and then he added, or drugs. And he added that because nobody drank liquor in San Francisco in the 60s. They didn't need to drink liquor. They had no interest in liquor. But they were doing other things, right? Do not sell liquor or drugs was what he talked to us about one morning. And the Zen center that I kind of grew up in was about a half-hour walk from the Haight-Ashbury, something like that. And it was sort of at the beginning of the Haight-Ashbury, and those people, let's see how I'm suffering. Mm-hmm. Look at that. The minute I dichotomize, there's a lack of stillness. There's rigidity. There's stickiness. So folks would come over from the Haight-Ashbury and join us in our meditation. That's better, isn't it? And there'd be various things going on during breaks. When we'd be doing Kinhin, they'd be out doing other things. I won't talk about that, because I didn't go out there. And so in his talk, do not sell liquor or drugs, he talked about how because we're so insecure, we're always trying to sell something to somebody. And when we find something that will give us finally some hope, we really want people to buy it. We really want people to get it. And he said, and that includes Buddhism. And he said, and that includes Zazen. Don't sell Zazen to people. If you sell Zazen to people, they won't really open their hearts. They'll just do it to try to be someone instead of just completely engaging in it. He said, so if you want to be a Buddhist missionary, you can be one, but don't sell Buddhism. You can discover what it is to be a missionary without doing any selling. Any selling. So that's not preaching on oneness. That's not preaching on oneness. And the day after he gave that talk, I was in there. Oh, maybe not the day after. You know, I don't remember. These things from happened all those years ago, they're all... I mean, if I'm still smelling my grandmother's tapioca, I mean, what can I tell you about something that happened in the 1960s? Anyway, something did happen, because I remember this. Maybe a day after, a week after, I was in the car with him. He didn't drive, and people always drove in places, and the car reeked of marijuana. It just reeked of marijuana. And he was not a dumb man. I mean, he had smelled marijuana. And so he got in the car, and actually he got in the back seat because he said we were going to go to Tassajara, and he said I'm getting in the back seat. My son told me to sit in the back seat so I won't get in an accident. I happen to remember that. You know how we remember little bits and pieces of things? I thought, that is weird. I'm sitting in the front seat. What's the deal there? I'm only in my early 20s. This guy is, you know, in his 60s. I got a long... But anyway, excuse me. And And so he says, very quietly, people look at him. People are looking at him. Gets in the car and they're looking at him. And a couple of people looking kind of stoned. And he looks at them and he says, I'm not for or against marijuana. I'm just trying to show people our way. That's all he says. That's all he says. That's all he ever says. Nothing more. No preaching on oneness. Emptiness. No stickiness. No stickiness. And of course, everybody loved him. We all loved him. We all still do love him. And of course, when he said, I'm just trying to show people our way, he didn't say our in some big fancy way. He just said our way. And that was an encouragement koan. So it ended, the last part of that koan, the first part was, I'm not for or against marijuana. The second was encouragement, which I'm going to talk about next time. Encouragement. That encouraged us. That even encouraged my stone friends. They were encouraged. Do you understand? A little bit about that. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say for today, and I can take a question or two or a comment or two if there's a question or a comment. Question or a comment? Yeah, Matt.
Maybe you could just talk a little more about our way. I know there's another story about Suzuki with the Janis Joplin.
Yeah.
Doesn't he say that at first I thought this wasn't our way?
Yeah, kind of.
And just like, because even that creates that dichotomy, obviously, with our way, and then there's other ways. And you don't kind of say.
Well. We have to have a practice. We have to do a practice to get ourselves unstuck. We have to do a practice. And can we do it in a way that doesn't judge others? Is it possible to do that practice without faulting others for not doing it? Or faulting others for continuing to refuse to even face the possibility that they could get unstuck themselves? Or deciding to get unstuck the way they want to get unstuck? So that's all I can say about it. We need to do a practice to do this. But do we have to tell others that it's the true way? I mean, I don't know. I have no idea what true is. It's what we do to get unstuck. It's what I was taught by my teachers to do to get unstuck. So, is it better or worse than what 800 other people do, ministers in other churches? Is that even relevant? To me? No, I don't know. I want to be kind and open to everybody else. And I don't want to try too hard to be kind, because if I try too hard to be kind, I'll be inauthentic. So I just be open, right? As if somebody is doing really something stupid, and I think if they're a fundamentalist, if they're a Buddhist or a Christian or an atheist, that are really sticky, a sticky fundamentalist atheist. My father was a fundamentalist atheist. Give me a break. He was no different than the fundamentalist Christians that were a few blocks away from us. And then the fundamentalist Buddhists. We shouldn't be stuck. You shouldn't be stuck. You shouldn't be stuck. You're more stuck than she. But Tim is the most unstuck. Except for Reb. Reb. Next to Reb. Tim is nothing. Tim is a stuck guy, right? et cetera, right? But the mind does. That's my answer. Anybody else?